Hello and welcome to Talking Capital. I'm Ian Barnard, CEO of CapGen. Each month, I'm joined by a member of our investment team or a guest from one of the investors in our universe to talk about the investment themes and opportunities that are available today to family investors. What is CapGen? We're a private investment office for families with capital. Our clients are sophisticated, internationally minded investors, and what we do is to help them make the most of their capital and to seek out investment opportunities across any asset class in any region of the world. So in the course of these episodes, you can expect us to cover a globally diversified portfolio of assets and sectors, be that bricks and mortar or derivatives. In summary then, this is a podcast where we discuss the questions that we think are playing on the minds of sophisticated long-term investors. If that sounds up your street, do please subscribe and you'll enjoy a new episode published on the first Thursday of each month. Welcome to Talking Capital. Today's interview is the last in our three-part series on investing in emerging markets. As a quick reminder, episode one a couple of months ago was with Robert Sears, our CIO, talking about the broad question of what part emerging markets might play within a portfolio and talking about the broad macro environment. We then, a month ago, had Mario Cristopace, the director in our research team, talk about the search that he had undertaken to find the right manager to manage a portfolio of emerging market equities. And I'm delighted to be joined by Ali Akai, who is the Chief Investment Officer at Carhi Capital, which is our chosen manager to talk about how he invests money in emerging markets. So Ali, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
We're going to do this, as always, in three parts. First of all, a bit on you and your firm's background and history, then about your general investment philosophy and style, how you go about choosing the stocks you buy, and then finally focusing in on one particular stock and trade that you particularly like and you think particularly illustrates what makes you special.
Excellent.
Maybe we can start, though, Ali, by a fun fact about you. So listeners can learn something about you that others might not know.
Yes. One thing I would say that differentiates me from people who have been in the business for a very long time is that most of them, almost all of them, had some passion for markets, investing, etc. at an earlier age. In my case, I had none of it. I hadn't the foggiest idea about investing or pecuniary affairs, and I wanted to be a historian, and then I came to study at UPenn Wharton, and our family finances had deteriorated to such an extent by that point that I knew I had to do something for a living, and I had a fortuitous meeting with the chap who was running the Huntsman program at that point, and there was a dual degree program between the Wharton School and the College of Art and Sciences, and he asked me where I went to school and what I did and what I thought about this ex prime minister of Turkey, and who was also an alumni of my high school, and I said that she was not only was she incompetent but also she was quite venal, and that answer helped me impressed him. Because he used to be an advisor to the Turkish government in affairs of privatization. And he said, "I completely agree. Thank you for your honesty, for your honest answer. And would you be interested in joining the Huntsman program and staying at Wharton and doing whatever else you'd like to do at the Liberal Arts College?" And I said, yes. And that's the beginning of my transition to business and investing, et cetera, et cetera. So in a meandering way, I got to the current path that I've been on.
And rolling the clock forward, Ali, is there a time when you go back to that passion, do you think?
I do. I'm always, I'm spending, every 3 minutes reading or various periods of history. And I have a very broad range. And I happen to be lucky in running into famous historians. Actually, yesterday on a flight I ran, I sat next to Sir Anthony Beaver, and spent a good deal taking the precious time he probably scheduled for relaxation on debating the Soviet archives. And so, yes, to the extent that I get the chance, I devote myself to my original course or passion.
Fantastic, fantastic. Well, from there to markets and investment, and you start out on one path and then life happens and you go down this other path. So we've got to the bit, Ali, where you move away from history. Can you take us from there to here? So a bit about your professional history and then where Kai Hai comes from and what the dream was that you had when you set it up.
Excellent. So I'll do a thumbnail sketch of my career. Once I graduated from the Huntsman program, Wharton and UPenn, I got my first job at McKinsey doing corporate finance and financial institutions and out of New York. And I did quite a few international assignments. I worked for the Central Bank of Turkey in the last banking crisis. I worked in Brazil advising a family-owned conglomerate. And I guess I did McKinsey because I didn't really know what I wanted to do and seemed like a safe option. But working in for different clients in different emerging markets, particularly the whole central bank experience, in the aftermath of a banking crisis, showed me that EM in its dysfunction is a more interesting place to be, and probably suited my intellectual interests and at least piqued my interest. And then I got a job at Goldman Sachs this was pre-Volcker days, so they had mini hedge funds in different parts of the business. So I worked for one of them under the equities division. It was the risk arbitrage group, which later became, I think, GSIP. And I did mostly LATAM equities and bonds. And there I learned the nuts and bolts of the business. It was a event-driven kind of approach. So learned the basics of that and lots of decision trees and nodes and probabilities. And I guess that suited my analytical nature. And then left that group with some of my colleagues and joined HBK, which is a multi-strat fund. And there they had a very knowledgeable, accomplished group of professionals investing in EM macro, VM fixed income. And I, with my colleagues, formed the equities counterpart. And it was it's a great team, great dialogue, lots of learnings for me from the macro group or fixed income group in terms of how you extract information from rate curves, CDS, currencies, and various macro instruments into usable information for an equity investor. And I left HBK to join SAC in London. And subsequently, I wanted to launch my own firm, Career Capital, I had multiple seed offers, and I went with the Blackstone Group, and they seeded my fund 14 and a half years ago, and subsequently bought them out. But that's the beginning of that's the thumbnail sketch of my career.
Super helpful, Ali, and I think takes us effortlessly to what it is you learned in those various places, what you thought was useful learning, what perhaps you discarded, and which shaped what you started out thinking you were going to do at Carré Capital when you set it up.
Well, I guess at McKinsey, I learned that I could never thrive at a service-oriented organization, that I didn't have the right flexibility and right attitude. And at Goldman, I learned that I would not climb up the greasy pole, and I wasn't very good at politics. But joke aside, McKinsey was great at giving you the skills to quickly get up to date on a certain industry or subsector, and tools you could utilize to achieve that. And I think being a generalist of a sort and being investing in EM, which is such a heterogeneous and diverse sort of investment set, that comes in very, very handy. At Goldman, working at an old event-driven sort of investment group, I think it was the rigor they employ in thinking probabilistically about the world was something that I took with me and I still practice. And at HBK, working with our fixed income counterparts, gleaning macro, very useful information from macro variables and being very comfortable with them is quite important, given that if you look at stock dispersion in emerging markets, a third of it happens on the index level. Before you get to industry and country, there is a significant macro component, and you have to be comfortable with that. And SAC, the focus on risk management, optimization of risk reward at all times, trying to vary size so they can extract a 25% return from a 15% annual stock appreciation, being in the right size at the right points of time, and downsizing when risk reward or conviction is not there. That variation of size and risk management was very important to me.
And I guess all of us, when we set up businesses, believe that there's a gap or there's something distinctive that we can contribute. Now, you know, there are many, many motivations for setting up a business. You know, one of them clearly is just autonomy and independence and, you know, challenging yourself and all of those things and growth and development and creating something. So I'm going to take all of that for granted. But I suspect that for most of us, there's also that belief that there's something distinctive that, you know, this new firm can contribute to the market that isn't really there.
Yeah, we have to recognize a market opportunity and opening, right? Like any entrepreneur. I guess in my case, I looked at how EM equities shops at that point operated. And there was, I saw that some of the best practices that the best in class US equity houses employed, especially on the hedge fund side, the Vikings, the Citadels, and many other storied shops, compared to how EM equities was being staffed and how people went about investing, I thought there is a gap. And there's no reason why, if you assemble a world-class group of EM professionals, that you can't invest in EM equities with the sort of best-in-class practices more developed market professionals are using. And I saw that there was a group of people who were very much believers in emerging market equities, I think they were investing in EM because they were from emerging markets, or they fell in love with emerging markets, part of emerging markets, and they believed in the story of those countries, you know, emerging. And in my case, I'm agnostic on most things, especially the future. So I don't really have a big belief in countries emerging or not emerging, and I don't really have a special regard or love for any of the markets that I invest in. I just see a group of very heterogeneous countries, high volatility, obvious coverage gaps, biases, etc., all contribute to making EM a good vessel for extracting alpha. And I think that is probably the philosophical difference that sets us apart from most of our brethren, because we're essentially there to extract alpha, and we don't really have an overarching thesis of an asset class, you know, emerging or outperforming or growing. I mean, it is great if it does that over the long term, but our real interest is in the extraction of alpha, honing our craft so we can extract the most alpha possible.
Interesting. And if I just jump back to the conversation I had with Mario, I think we for me, what we teased out of there was from a Capgen point of view, and I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, Ali, there were two, you know, particular motivations for this focus on emerging markets. One is the one that you describe, which is, if you like, the sector and long-term one, which are is that these are, you know, these are, there's, well, it's a large volume of markets with lots of inefficiencies, not necessarily terribly well researched, all of the things that we can point to. Because if you assert that you are generating alpha, there's somebody out there that has to be having negative alpha because the total sum of alpha in the universe is zero and all that sort of thing. So,
absolutely. It's an inherently adversarial.
You've got to identify who you're extracting. So this we share. But I guess I was just in a way noting that we probably also see something of a cyclical attraction for emerging markets, which I think is part of this broader, what does the world like it look like if sort of dollar hegemony doesn't disappear but is somewhat mitigated. But I think you're saying, Ali, that for you, you're not banking on that. There's no emerging market Kool-Aid to be drunk. You just see it as a really, really attractive.
Actually, let me clarify that a little further. I think it's the client's choice and prerogative to drink the Kool-Aid or not. But once they have decided, once they're bitten by the EM bug, then hopefully we can help them extract the most out of emerging markets. Because I don't find it, given how nuanced my own personal views are and the fact that I'm such an agnostic on most matters, and perhaps I lack the power of persuasion, I don't want to have the conversation of trying to persuade a potential client that emerging markets is going to, is what, 40% of global GDP and, you know, less than 10% of global market cap, and eventually will catch up, and, you know, valuations and relative valuations and dollar. I mean, I have some views there, but I would rather have the client be persuaded on the merits of, you know, investing in emerging markets, and I can be the tool with which the client extracts the most alpha.
I get that. So you're saying you may or may not have a view on the emerging market Kool-Aid, from the point of view of your business and your stock picking, you, even if you have that view, you're not going to let it trespass upon the choices and decisions you make.
Precisely. Trying to stay as dispassionate as possible.
But maybe Kool-Aid's a really unfortunate analogy to use because it implies that there's nothing really there. So let's take that away and just talk about the emerging market story, which is essentially the one that says, look, this is where all the growth is. What you see is that financial markets expand to follow economies typically. So as economies get larger and more developed, their financial markets expand to match them. And therefore, there is a case for it.
Yes, the financial broadening is definitely an EM story. And it marches forward at a very uneven, or countries march forward at a very uneven pace. So, but just to give you a personal anecdote, when I first started investing in emerging markets 25 years ago, it was Latin America, you know, Russia, Turkey, etc. These countries with one beer company, one supermarket, a couple of banks. It was very old school, very macro tied. And your views on, you know, we speak to macro managers and say, oh, I like Brazil. Let me buy a little bit of Petrobras. Let me add some equity risk to my fixed income risk. And I was there saying, well, you know, why do you bother with an oil company if you're, you know, inherently bullish on Brazilian macro? But let's leave that aside. Nowadays, emerging markets, the composition has changed so much. The biggest stock in our universe is TSMC, which is almost an 11% weight, and it's tied with an umbilical cord to the fortunes of Nasdaq and of the Mag 7. And without TSMC, there's no AI with that. So, and then, you know, we can go down the list. There's Hynix, there's Samsung, there's Tencent, there's, you know, all kinds of tech companies. If you look at the EM index, it's more techy than Europe. and there are defense companies there. And there's a lot of market broadening in places like India, China. And frankly, they don't need the whole old narrative of you know, north to south, the capital comes from the west. That's kind of old news. They you know, in this year, foreigners have been big sellers of massive sellers of India, and the market has done okay because the locals, the marginal, the allocation comes from the locals. And it's the same with a lot of emerging markets. They have not only do they have much more developed equity markets than, you know, 25 years ago, they also have more sophisticated participants and local participants. So it's become a much more difficult game, much more nuanced game, where in every situation you have to think about the investor base in a much more nuanced fashion.
Before we turn to your favorite illustrative trade, can we just talk a little bit, Ali, about the challenges, balances of running a long short and a long only book? And how you think about that? Is it one space in your mind? Is it two spaces in your mind? Do they run independently? Or
yeah, I would say it is really one investment engine that fires both products. And since most of the work that we're doing on sectors and subsectors inevitably will lead to long and short ideas. You know, there are winners and losers in every technological or business process in change. So pricing power migrates from parts from suppliers to OEMs and vice versa. There's cyclicality. There's always winners and losers. So the more industry work we do, the deeper that work is, the more long and short ideas we're going to get. And in terms of implementation, there are nuances that we need to take into consideration. For instance, the long only, you can have errors of omission and then errors of commission. And I think the errors of omission, type two errors, can be just as bad if you're, or even worse, if you're one part of the market is moving and you're performing and you're not exposed to it, then it can cause real damage. But then once you've seen that, you can, I think as a long short manager, I take a lot of value out of the times when I put on my long only cap and think about how a long only will act and what that can do in terms of flows. For instance, if I see that as most long only managers are a shorter theme or net underweight a theme, and that theme is starting to work, that means not only the theme will work not only on its own merits, but on the flow angle with long-only managers covering their underweight. For instance, that was quite potent. That was a quite potent force in the beginning of the year with China Tech when they started to come in and cover their underweights. And that was something that we also relied on to give our long China Tech thesis on the long short fund another layer of support. So I think it's there are slight differences, but I find the mental exercise to be very synergistic.
And do you, just in terms of time allocation, do you say, okay, today at 10 o'clock is a long only product hour or 2 hours or 30 minutes, and then, you know, 11 o'clock is the long short?
To be honest, I haven't had that degree of agency over my time since I started investing 25 years ago. And that level of agency has been further reduced after having kids. But the process is a lot more organic than that, in the sense that I'm spending most of my time speaking to my colleagues. We're 27 people going to 28. They're from São Paulo to Beijing. We have people visiting companies, talking to the market, talking to experts, going to conferences, and they're constantly taking notes, coming up with insights. And you know, my job is to hear them out, look at our dashboard, which is the comprehensive system that we have built to encapsulate and to digitize and encapsulate all the activity we undertake on the front office side, on the investment side. And we have functions. We have our own model for predicting country level outperformance. We have our own metrics of sector and country momentum. We have our own metrics of crowding. And it's a live system and fed with the, I guess, intelligence and insights of all of my those 27 people. So I'm speaking to them. I'm working through our systems, and I'm trying to see and see how that relates, or how the market is taking all those all that information, and how the market is reacting. And as a market practitioner, I inherently respect the market as well. So I'm trying to triangulate all that and come to decisions. And I think, at the end of the day, yes, we make a lot of our investments on the long only side are we have an 80%+ overlap with the long side of the long short fund. So most orders will be pro rata. It's only when we make decisions to be overweight or underweight a certain theme or country or sector, or we say we don't know enough, so let's try to be as, and this is binary, let's try to be as close to the market weight as possible. These are all decisions that we make, but then we have the systems to just program that, and then the rest of the time we're just so that we can be focused on stocks rather than making big top down calls.
Oh, thank you. That was great. And we should probably turn to favorite illustrative trade. So I guess the purpose of this partly is to allow you to showcase, you know, something that's gone well, but also through that to see a very practical window on the choices that you're making, because you start with a very large universe and you have to end up with a small number of choices.
Brilliant. The idea that I've chosen to talk about today that encapsulates many aspects of what we do is our investment, long-standing investment in Embraer, the Brazilian aircraft manufacturer. And the reason I chose Embraer from the beginning, you know, the genesis of the thesis was about change, identifying change. And I think that's kind of a differentiating factor. There are many good ways to invest. A lot of investors start with identifying great companies. We start with trying to identify where is significant change happening, and change in terms of regulation, technology, market dynamics, market concentration, geopolitics, etc., and see if that change is underappreciated by the market. And the genesis of the Embraer investment was basically my deputy and I looking at the travails of Boeing and to a certain extent Airbus in the supply chain, and saying, well, there's got to be, for every loser, there's got to be a winner. And when we went, and then we included our colleagues sitting in São Paulo in that chat. And to our surprise, we found the local investment community and also the Latin investors, etc., pushing back heavily, saying, well, these are not interchangeable products. A regional jet is not a narrow body. There's no impact on Embraer. We said, okay, well, we follow a lot of airlines. So I'll ask my colleague following low cost or just airlines in different places, talk to the airlines you cover and ask them, how are they dealing with a duopoly that can't deliver planes for 6 years? and when we went to the airlines, they said, well, what the Embraer analyst and the buy side and covering that is telling you is hogwash. We need the planes. And if yes, you know, you might have training needs, you might have other needs. You can't, or, you know, buy an entirely new class of planes easily. It's not the easiest decision. But if we can't get planes for 5 and 6 years and demand is here, we'll absolutely consider more Embraers. And that was the finding that we went out with, thinking, well, this significantly increases the chances of them, you know, building up their order book. But it didn't stop there. Since we started looking at it, we also found out, well, they have a significant defense business that, in the context of what happened with Russia and all the I guess the retreat of the US in providing security to them, there is going to have to be a significant need for various armies, whether it's India, or Europe, to gain additional capacity to move their troops and material around. I mean, Europe has a 2,000 kilometer border with Russia and proxies. India needs to be able to deal with Pakistan, its border with China, et cetera, et cetera. And Embraer has this great multi-lifter, a medium-body military aircraft that is NATO certified. And when we looked at it, again, the investor base and the locals that we've spoken to, or the analysts covering the stock, had done better sort of work in terms of appreciating what the TAM for that product could be. Since this company was, outgrowing its shell and becoming much more of an international company with JVs in, from India to Poland to Turkey to UAE, without, especially on the defense side, we said, well, this is great because we have people on the ground in these places. They can do work to assess the potential of the defense business. And that's what we've done. And we've come up with significant upside in terms of the addressable market for their military cargo aircraft. And then we said, well, there's another part of the business, which is the maintenance repair operation. The apt comparison is the Gillette, for example, the razor versus the cartridge. When you sell an aircraft, it's X margin. But if you do maintenance operation on it for many, many years, since it's a heavily regulated business, the returns are substantially higher, and the margin is higher. And what we noticed with Embraer is that for years they have underpunched their potential in terms of the MRO operation because they didn't have the assets in the US and Europe. And now they had built those physical assets, and they not only could they do MROs, provide MRO services for their own expanding fleet, but also service outside engines, etc., in a time when there was a global shortage, again, partly due to what happened with Boeing and Airbus and supply chains. So we looked at independent MRO operations listed in the US and private ones, and got a sense of what is going on, the significant change that's going on in the industry, and applied the lessons to Embraer. So long story short, we uncovered more and more upside as we were looking at this company. And I think it demonstrates several aspects of our core strength. I think being able to look at globalizing companies with the help of a multi-jurisdictional investment team, the iterative nature of what we do, because we kept finding new angles, and we always went back to check our findings with the market or the constituency that moves the stock. The multi-layered nature of the thesis, because we can, one or two angles might not be enough. The more angles you have, the higher certitude you have in creating alpha. And the ability to combine industry, country, and multiple industries, multiple jurisdictions in one investment thesis. So I thought that was interesting, and that encapsulates our process. But in terms of the way we traded, when we were relatively alone, saying this company has this tremendous opportunity because of the whole Boeing issue, we were quite big, 5-6% size. And as that angle became more widely known, we reduced the size of the position. And then when we saw that defense orders could be at the next layer, we increased the position again. And then after we were proven right on the defense orders coming through, we reduced it. So that tactical, for a trade that, for a stock that trades heavily on news flow and order book, it does make sense to vary the size, because there are periods of long periods of stagnant or down performance.
And how long have you held it, Ali?
I think 2 and change years. Yeah.
And you're happy with it and you're going to continue to hold, subject to?
Subject to price performance and risk return and new information, of course. But yeah, we have, currently a 1.5% position. So I think we'll hold on to that size.
And just in terms of, because these are listed securities and therefore, you know, tremendous amount of flexibility, do you set yourself hard targets, or is it just a dialogue you have as you're going along as the market moves?
We have a risk reward that we have a target price and a downside price, and we have a conviction level that we set by assigning a 0 to 10 score on the base of country conviction, industry conviction, management and shareholder alignment and catalysts. So it's a 10-point system. And then we have our risk reward. And as the market changes, the risk reward changes, the price changes and the risk reward changes. And the conviction, we try to update on a weekly basis before our investment committee meeting.
Brilliant. Ali, that was super helpful. I suspect we might have run over a bit. So I'm going to say thank you very much. Thank you for all of that, all the way from the fun fact to the reasoning around Embraer as a stock pick, illustrating, I think, what I take away from that is clear research driven, but also the global platform. So you can take an incipient idea from one place, check it in others, and then execute it in another place. So I think back to one of the reasons that Mario talked about back in the previous episode, this global presence in a boutique manager. It's really, really quite distinctive. So Ali, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Thank you for joining us. Bye-bye. A link to Capgen's privacy notice and full terms can be found in this podcast summary description and on our website. Thank you.